Next matter is in the matter of the marriage of Shelikov.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Brendan Patrick for appellant Rhea Rolfe. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. My client is an attorney, sanctioned, and had attorney's fees awarded against her for filing a lien that's allowed by statute, is reflected in case law as being a practice. To have an attorney's lien in marital dissolution cases. And I think I'll start going right to that main point of this case about whether or not an attorney lien is appropriate and allowable in a marital dissolution. The first point, the statute itself does not exclude or exempt in any way marital dissolution cases. They are reflected in cases. No direct holdings where it was an issue, but the fact that cases have come through this court with attorney liens in marital dissolution cases without it being disputed reflects that the courts and attorneys and clients have not considered this to be an issue. In the Whitmire case, a $50,000 judgment was entered as part of the dissolution, in order to sort of cash out the wife.
So where does the trial court get the idea that these statutes don't apply in family law cases? I mean, there must be something going on in the real world to make the trial court think that.
I don't know. It is a little bit of a mystery. The trial, she simply said it was under the circumstances not appropriate, not proceeds of an action. The trial court may have been swayed a little bit by some statements in the briefing that said that the trial court had earlier dismissed the lien. But the trial court, in the later ruling, the ruling that's before this court, didn't pick up on that language. But if the trial court were under the impression that the lien had been dismissed in the ruling on the earlier motion, then perhaps that swayed the court toward ruling. But the court didn't enter any findings of fact that were really truly factual findings and didn't give a clear legal explanation of the court's ruling, but did find my client intransigent for bringing this motion or this lien that's reflected in case law and not disallowed by the statute.
Does the briefing and the motion below by the other side shed any light on what the court was asked to rely on?
I don't think so. Not beyond what each of the parties has briefed to the court in our briefs. No theories that didn't get restated in the briefs. I think it. There's also.
Well, what about the fact of the first motion? I mean, the court was aware that the motion was made under 244, and that it wasn't factually a case of dismissal. That was inappropriate. Clearly inappropriate under the statute. It was just denied. Wouldn't filing such a motion under those facts be basis for sanction?
I don't think so. The court didn't. I see where you're getting. But I think the key point is that the court in the first ruling did not dismiss the lien.
It also didn't impose sanctions.
It did not impose sanctions. It reserved that issue and recognized that there would be further adjudication of this fee issue.
It expressly reserved sanctions in the first
I'm sorry,
order.
Not sanctions, but there was a request for attorney's fees, and that was reserved to be heard with the attorney's fees on attorney's fees. It's getting a little confusing here, but that issue was reserved, and the court anticipated that there would be further adjudication, that this did not dismiss the lien and expected, I imagine, that the issue would come up in due course, just not in the context of a 244.
And so the motion to release the funds also was a motion for fees and sanctions.
There was, with the motion to disperse the funds, there was a fee request requesting approximately $3,000 related to the first motion and about $3,000 related to the second motion. And then the judge issued a $3,500 fee award based on intransigence without citing what the intransigent behavior was, whether it was something to do with the first motion or the second. There was no oral argument. It's
what
unclear.
What is the correct result if we agree with your analysis? What happens going forward?
The correct result, I think, is to reverse that order, reinstate the lien, and reinstate.
Funds in the registry of the court anymore, are there?
I'm sorry?
There are no funds left in the registry of the court.
There are no funds left in the registry of the court, but there is the judgment and continuing payment. So there are.
Do we know that that hasn't been paid?
We don't. We don't.
This could be a period.
With respect to the. The principal
paid off the principal that was to compensate for the interest in the business. There's nothing left for the lien to attach to, is there?
Yes, that's right. There would be, however, the attorney fee judgment entered against my client and the sanctions. She always had the option of simply going forward with an independent action, but the stigma of having being found intransigent.
Of the $3,500 based on the request for fees for the first action, what part of that is inappropriate as sanctions in your mind?
We don't know what it was for. Well, one, the whole thing, because intransigence is not a basis for an attorney fee award aside from between two spouses.
But isn't an award of attorney's fees possible under 244 for basically filing a claim for relief that the statute doesn't recognize?
Under other theories, it would be. It is, however, not clear on this order that that's.
So if we vacate the sanctions, should the trial court have an opportunity to revisit the award of fees based on the first motion?
That would not be inappropriate. Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell either from the record whether, you know.
The record is simply silent.
It's an award of fees, or it's a sanction, or it's a combination of both.
Right.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Stephanie Mesplay here on behalf of Natalia Shulikoff. We are asking the Court to affirm the trial court's order dispersing the funds to Ms. Shulikoff and awarding attorney's fees. First, I think it's appropriate to clarify exactly what happened at the trial court. First, on February 23rd, Ms. Rolfe, Ms. Shulikoff's former attorney, filed a notice of attorney's lien. The notice named RCW 6040010 did not cite any particular subsection.
Any case that requires that citation?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor. But I do believe that it plays into Ms. Rolfe's attempts to essentially foreclose on the lien, which is why sanctions were appropriate in this case. The main issue that was argued in later motions was whether the funds that were in the court registry were proceeds of an action. Now,
was that the basis for the argument about the 244 motion that Ms. Rolfe made?
No, that was the basis for her response to the motion to disperse that was later made.
Two separate motions.
There were two separate motions, correct.
Ms. Rolfe brings under RCW 2.44, and the court denies that motion because the statute doesn't address her circumstances. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's my understanding that the statute that she, that 244, did not apply in light of the RPCs.
Your client brings a motion to have the funds that are in the registry of the court released to your client, and Ms. Rolfe responds, I have an attorney lien, separate apart from the 244 issue. I have an attorney lien that's authorized by this other statute, and these funds are subject to that lien, and I should get paid before anything gets released to Ms. Rolfe's former client. That's the process for the second.
That is correct.
And after that, the court orders the release of the funds and an award of fees.
That is correct.
And do we have any clue as to the legal theory under which the court awarded those fees beyond the words intransigence?
The court does not give any indication in its order what basis it relied on.
We know if it relied upon the fees incurred for both hearings.
It did not, because the fees incurred for both hearings was greater than the amount that was awarded.
Fair to assume from the record that the only fees awarded were the fees incurred in connection with the motion to release proceeds and extinguish lien.
I don't know that we can infer that from the record because the trial court did not specify in its order.
Correspond to the amount requested for the second hearing.
I would have to go back and look at the record for that, Your Honor, but it should be reflected in the motion that was put forward and the declaration that was put forward. I believe the amounts were similar, though.
The amount the court awarded is the same as the amount that was requested in connection with the second motion. Would you then agree that's what was awarded?
I would then agree, yes. The central issue here, however, as counsel argued, was whether the amount that was in the court registry did indeed constitute proceeds that would be subject to 60-40-010. And our argument is no, that it is not. Now, Ross v. Scannell, one of the earlier cases discussing this statute, recognizes the importance of the RPCs in connection with this statute. The RPCs make special exceptions for dissolution cases. In dissolution cases, attorneys are absolutely prohibited from taking an interest in their client's property. They're prohibited from representing a client in a dissolution on a contingency fee basis.
Is there anything that prohibits an attorney in a family law case from taking a lien against assets?
In
Jane Doe walks into my office. It's a family law case. Looks like it's going to be very contentious. There's a lot of money involved. She has real property she owns. It's her separate property, so there's no issue about the other spouse participating. And the lawyer says, to secure the payment of my fee, I'd like you to sign a deed of trust securing that, encumbering this real property. Is that a violation of that RPC?
It's a violation of a different RPC.
Which one?
1.8.
And why does it violate
RPC 1.8? 1.8 prohibits an attorney from entering into a business relationship with a client and taking an interest in
relationship securing payment of your fee.
The comments
the lawyer referred Jane Doe to independent counsel about the issue of whether she should sign the deed of trust.
If she was referred to independent counsel, then it would be in compliance with 1.8. The comments to 1.8.
The family law lawyer can have a lien in the assets of the family law attorney's client, provided there was independent advice provided about whether to enter into the relationship.
I believe 1.8 does contemplate that. There was no such arrangement here.
Well, that's because this is an involuntary lien after non-payment.
Correct. Defining proceeds to include property settlements in a dissolution is essentially just a runaround on the contingency fee prohibition. In either case, you have the attorney saying,
why is it a runaround contingency fee? Ms. Rolfe was only asking to be paid by the hour. She wasn't asking for a percentage. And she wasn't asking to be paid depending on whether the recovery was favorable or unfavorable. She was just asking to be paid out of what her client received.
Well, the contingency fee prohibition applies because there's...
So what's contingent about this fee?
There's nothing contingent about the fee.
So why does the prohibition against the contingency fee play any role in the analysis?
Because in both situations, you have an attorney saying that I am entitled to a portion of your marital property, regardless of what happens, that is allotted to you by the court. And the only difference...
Are you telling us family law lawyers have no right to get paid if they don't get paid on time?
No, I am not saying that. They have other means.
It doesn't come from marital property.
It can come from separate property. The attorney can also.
Separate property. The court asked before the separate and community property of both parties can allocate the division of that property in its discretion.
The property in question here is community property. We're not reaching the separate property issue. The attorney in a dissolution action has other means. It can. So we're discussing only the provision in that statute on proceeds. If the husband had property that was owned by Ms. Shulikov.
He owes his ex-wife money under the settlement agreement, so he holds cash that he owes to her.
Right.
Would he be able to garnish, would Ms. Rolfe, with a judgment, be able to garnish that money?
Yes. Is that,
any different than what happened here?
In that case, you don't have an attorney lien asserted. It is a completely separate action. We're not saying that Ms. Rolfe is never going to be able to collect her fees.
It's the same fund that she's collecting from. It's using the judicial process. Why should we distinguish the two situations?
Because of the definitions of the word proceed in the lien statute.
Okay. Counsel, if we disagree with you on the scope of the term proceeds, do you agree that the sanctions necessarily fall away?
I do not. If the sanctions were, I believe that the sanctions were appropriate for the earlier motion, the one brought pursuant to 2.44, because that particular motion was not permitted by either statute or
but I don't see a contemporaneous award of sanctions when that motion was denied. I don't see a separate request for sanctions specifically on that motion. And I don't see language by the trial court that awards sanctions specifically based on that motion. What are we to do with that?
The motion that to request attorney's fees did address the earlier motion as a basis for an award of attorney's fees as having been filed improperly. Thank you, Your Honor.
If I may pick up with this attorney fee issue, Judge Applewick had a question earlier about what basis was cited for the attorney fee award. And at Clerk's Paper 13 is Ms. Shulikov's request for attorney's fees, and the only basis she cites there is intransigence, which would be, as a matter of law, an inappropriate basis for the award. That's what the trial court relied on without distinguishing which.
Well, I take it that your client was asked to release the lien and allow the funds to be distributed, and she refused. And if the trial court believed that those funds were not proceeds, then she could fairly characterize that as intransigence, which, you know.
Yes, in a lay sense of the word. If this court were to go there, it would be the first case granting attorney's fees for the basis of intransigence, except between spouses where there's a special duty. It would be a new exception to the American rule.
Doesn't an attorney owe a fiduciary duty to both current and former clients, depending on the circumstances?
Yes.
So if the attorney was asserting something not provided for by the law, wouldn't there be a breach of a duty owed by the attorney to that former client?
Yes, there may be. Whether that is a basis for an award of attorney's fees was not.
Usually a breach of a fiduciary duty gives rise to the right to fees.
Yeah, there was no legal basis cited except for the intransigence.
Earlier I thought conceded that it would be appropriate to send this back and let the trial court sort this out with the correct law.
Well,
prevail on the lien.
And that's why I started my rebuttal with that, to make the point that it was not in the original request and there's no cross-appeal on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes our morning. Thank you.